Hi, this is John Hockenberry, and speaking to someone who clearly loves to listen at the time of their choosing, you should give the WNYC app a try, you know? Not only can you listen to this program, but it'll also automatically search for the kinds of stories and subjects you like. It's really cool, and it's free. There are other apps and radio stations available, but thanks for listening. Here's today's program. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry, and behold the sounds of the street of this nation. Here's the streets of New York. And here we go to the streets of Washington, D.C. And Oakland, California, where some of the biggest demonstrations took place this week. Talking about Michael Brown there, and of course in Ferguson, Missouri, at the center of a nation coming to grips with a deep divide between law enforcement and citizens. Speaking yesterday was Darren Wilson, the officer, who told ABC News he was just doing his job when he shot Michael Brown.
The gun was actually being jammed by his hand on top of the firearm. So I tried again, and again another click. And this time I'm like, this has to work, otherwise I'm going to be dead. He's going to get this gun away from me. Something's going to happen, and I'm going to be dead. So I pull a third time, and it finally goes off.
That was the first time you'd ever used your gun, right?
Yes, it was.
Why not stay in the car? He's running away.
My job isn't to just sit and wait.
So you felt it was your duty to give chase?
Yes, it was. That's what we were trained to do.
A look now at how our justice system treats these cases and seems to have a pattern of failure to get at the issues that police and citizens believe are dividing them and building explosive tension in places like Ferguson and other communities around the country. Joining us is Judge Nancy Gertner. She retired from the Federal District Court a few years ago and is now a senior lecturer at Harvard Law School. Welcome, Judge.
Nice to be here.
Judge, I want to step back a little in this case. When we try to test whether an officer had a reasonable expectation that his life was in danger, that was at issue in the Michael Brown case, how much does a judge or the justice system have to take into account his training, that there are pressures and provocations that come to bear just with an officer being present on the street? And how much sophistication is there supposed to be between law enforcement and the divisions that we see across the country? Are police supposed to be aware of these kinds of things?
Well, you raise an important point. You have to separate out, on the one hand, the law that is looking only at his perceptions and whether they were reasonable under the circumstances. What should be read into that, however, may be something completely different. Perhaps one should read into that, were his perceptions out of proportion to what was going on? Were his perceptions something that, whether officers ought to be trained to deal with minor offenses that then escalate into something like this? The sad thing is that what the Supreme Court has read into the word reasonableness is very much a carte blanche for officers. So a case that was decided only 3 months ago involving an encounter with a civilian that began with a bad taillight suddenly escalated. The guy takes off and the officer follows him and then shoots 15 shots into the car, killing the driver and the passenger. And the court said that that was a reasonable response to the fleeing felon under those circumstances. So the categories are very general, and the courts have read into them really standards that privilege police, you know, erring on the side of the police officer rather than on the individual. And the issues that you're raising about training, which are terribly important, don't necessarily feed into this analysis. They may feed into a civil rights lawsuit later on. What was the training that Wilson got? What was the supervision, etc.? But for the criminal case, the question is a much more narrow one.
And the Supreme Court has really made it the case that officers are permitted to view a suspect who is acting erratically. And I say this without trying to make any sort of inflammatory conversation here, in the same way as, you know, a wild bear or someone, if he was out in the woods and there was something scary happening. I mean, the court really doesn't distinguish between danger and anger and passions that might be caused because of some sociological dynamic on the street or just this pure, you know, monster steps out from behind a tree kind of danger that it sounds like the court has narrowed in its interpretation of officers' behavior. Am I getting this completely wrong?
Well, it's an interesting parallel. I mean, it's certainly taken from the view of the officer. And if the officer doesn't make the distinction you're drawing, the court says that's fine. There's literally language in the most recent Supreme Court case about deference to the split-second judgment of police officers. Well, that framework is an important one. Yes, they have to make split-second decisions. It also then privileges overreaction, regular and sustained overreaction in the way that you describe. In addition, when you add to this what we've been reading about the stop and frisk program in New York, where young African Americans are stopped at a higher percentage than anyone else, or the broken windows theory of policing, where the notion is that you want to, you know, want to stop turnstile jumping and all sorts of minor offenses. If you believe in that kind of policing, then the numbers of encounters between young African-American men and the police increase. If you then don't also read into this controlling excessive responses to really minor stimuli, and you allow excessive force to be used in those circumstances, then you have Ferguson, and then you have Garner, the Staten Island man, and you then have these kinds of situations.
So when people shout in crowds, they treat us like animals. It's not really hyperbole. I mean, you can sort of understand where they're coming from based on these narrow standards that the courts have built into the system. And our pathway to justice has to come from a completely different relationship between law enforcement and people on the street. Am I extrapolating, or is that a reasonable question to ask?
I think it is a reasonable question to ask. I mean, broadly speaking, what I was saying is that, you know, given the standards, you read into those situations your prejudices. There's no question about that. If you recall Rodney King, there was a video that was a horrifying video of Rodney King being beaten up. But the jury found for the officers, because of something that was said off the video, the notion that there's things that you don't see, ladies and gentlemen, that is not on the video, and in that portion of the encounter, the basically the jury read in their own prejudices, what it must have felt like to be facing someone like this. So you have to talk about retraining attitudes to the police and retraining how the police see the people that they serve. And I also think it has to be a change in the law so that courts provide incentives for this kind of accountability and this kind of retraining. If the courts are prepared to allow any kind of force to be legitimate, really, like the high-speed chase following a traffic stop with the 15 shots, then you have no incentives for police to change.
What's the path to a country that trusts its justice system so that we wouldn't have these kinds of demonstrations, in your view?
It's really critical. It's really critical that we deal with police individual encounters. We deal with racism in that way. I mean, the grand jurors, let me just sort of break it down. So the police officer says, here's what I saw. And there may be some basis for what he saw and how threatened he felt. But in fact, objectively, if you looked at it fully objectively, it wasn't true. But we say we give deference to his spur of the moment perceptions, which essentially means I give deference to his ability to, you know, use all his biases to deal with this young, larger African-American man. So I think that it's training. I think it's attitudinal. I think that the law has to change. I think there has to be stricter standards for when deadly force is used than we have enabled over the past couple of years.
Judge Nancy Gertner is retired from the Federal District Court and is now a senior lecturer at the Harvard Law School. Thank you so much, Judge.
You're welcome.
My name is Terrence, and I am calling from St. Louis, Missouri. I live here. Black men in particular, and black people generally, cannot receive the so-called justice that America claims to deliver.
My name's Kyle from St. Louis, Missouri. It seems like the police force is kind of a protection agency for the elite, and in St. Louis, they are the white people. And it just seems like we really disparage against the minorities in this community.
That's the view from St. Louis. It's not justice for all, it's justice for whites, some of you are saying. What about outside of St. Louis?
My name is Brian from New Hampshire. I think the cops just as soon shoot down a white guy as a black guy. It's got nothing to do with color. It's got all to do with power and arrogance.
I think part of the problem is that the country doesn't want to realize there is violence on the streets, and sometimes you have to meet violence with violence. It's not fun. It's not exciting. It's not a movie. It's real. And sometimes the outcome is tragic.
Hi, this is Tim from Philadelphia, and I think that we have to understand that too often black people are blaming white people, and it should be more so looking at blaming capitalism as a whole and what it's created in our country.
There's a lot of little young black men just gunning each other down every day for apparently no good reason. Why is the black community on fire for that as they are for this in Ferguson?
Those last two comments are more related than you might think. Two different worlds in America, and that's perhaps what's not sustainable here.
Bob from Brooklyn, New York. The system worked well in Ferguson, Missouri. Michael Brown was a thug. He committed a forcible robbery. The police officer defended himself. Case closed.
This is Barbara, and I'm calling from Jerseyville, Illinois, very close to St. Louis. And I have to say, I'm tired of this victim being portrayed as an innocent teen stealing cigarettes. This was a 300-pound aggressive man, and they don't show that video of him enough, where he shoves the guy down in this convenience store that he robbed. So it's a shame that he died, but I think any police officer would have done exactly the same thing, black or white.
My name is Peggy Nolan. I'm calling from Hollywood, Florida, and I'm appalled that we treat acting out teenage human beings as if they are some sort of lethal weapon and we have to kill them.
This is Jay from Keyport, New Jersey. The grand jury found nothing illegal about Darren Wilson's shooting of Michael Brown, and that may be the case. The conversation we need to have then is about changing the laws about what is legal for police to do. It should be nearly impossible for anyone, police or civilian, to use lethal force without consequence. The Darren Wilsons and indeed George Zimmermans of the world should not be confident that laws are on their side when they shoot an unarmed teen.
What are you hearing in those comments? Are you hearing facts and ideas that add to our understanding of what went on? Or are you hearing a parallel narrative, a parallel universe between whites and blacks and a system that has to change? We want to hear from you. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Find us on Facebook.com/The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from TIAA CREF, a financial services company helping to create financial outcomes that matter. Learn more at TIAA.org.
So let's go deeper into this question of systemic dysfunction now, and let's sketch out a provocative view. So whites see angry blacks who don't trust the justice system and all these Ferguson protests and protests around the nation. And they see that that black rage is an unwillingness to simply accept the grand jury's decision not to indict as an objective system working. There's rage over the lack of an indictment. At the same time, though, blacks may be viewing a very different white rage, long-held white rage over a loss of status and superiority over blacks that goes back to the Civil War and has expressed itself in a system that blacks perceive as being gamed against them and the poor, a system that in fact has become a machine of white rage, which may begin to explain why voter turnout among blacks is only 12%. Here to discuss this phenomenon is Professor Carol Anderson, Associate Professor of African American Studies and History at Emory University and the author of Bourgeois Radicals, the NAACP and the Struggle for Colonial Liberation, 1941-1960. Professor, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you so much for asking me.
So is this white rage phenomenon invisible because it's woven into the system in some way from the perspective of blacks?
Oh, absolutely. It's invisible because it doesn't need to take to the streets. It operates in the courts that look as impartial as possible, as justice being blind with her balanced scales. It looks like a Congress that's merely passing legislation to launch the war on drugs. It looks like county aldermen who are merely redrawing districts, but are in fact making very systemic decisions that rebalance and skew the system away from the narrative of America of being a just and equal society.
So when white professors and white news people say, look at all these angry blacks on the street, and then cut to a peaceful-sounding white academic, the calm of whites is actually a manifestation of this rage because whites have it pretty comfortable.
I would nuance that a bit to say that many whites are uncomfortable, that we have, though, a system that has made it possible for African Americans to be the default threat system, the default threat setting in America, and to be the problem in America. Without really engaging that there has been this ongoing struggle to make America America. And every time that that struggle moves forward, such as in the Civil War with that victory, you get an incredible backlash cloaked in the niceties of bureaucracy and government, such as the Black Codes that came out of the Civil War, or massive resistance that came out of the Brown decision, or Stand Your Ground, or the voter suppression laws that came out of Obama's victory. So these movements forward are always resisted massively by an entrenched bureaucracy. And one of the fallouts of that is that whites get hurt as well. The inability to deal with a justice system that is equitable means that we have channeled and funneled billions of dollars into a criminal justice system instead of where that funding needed to be, which was in quality education for everybody. And so I've heard lots about, African Americans just need to take responsibility. The problem with the system is that many African Americans do take responsibility, but that doesn't matter. They still have a target on them. They are still stopped and frisked. They are still followed. They are still discriminated against.
So is it a crazy kind of lefty, no one will pay any attention analogy to look at the car being overturned in Ferguson or in the demonstrations around the country, the police car being overturned, as an expression of black rage over this decision, but that a passage of a Stand Your Ground law in Florida or a Tea Party demonstration against providing benefits to the poor, that amounts to a kind of a turning over of the Constitution. It's white rage turning something else over. It just doesn't happen to be in the streets, and it's not a picture that goes on CNN.
Right. It's seen as civic engagement. As for the emphasis on the violent protest of African Americans around the nation, think about it. In North Carolina, Reverend William Barber has been mounting Moral Mondays, nonviolent protest against the laws that the North Carolina legislature is passing to systematically disfranchise the poor and African Americans. And not too many folks are paying attention to that. They don't hear that message. And that message is just as rooted in the systemic injustice that has sparked the uprising via Ferguson.
So where do we go? White rage, black rage, white rage within the system, black rage within the streets. Again, I've been asking this all week. I'm not seeing a bridge.
You know, and to me, part of that bridge, it really is about taking responsibility. And when I say taking responsibility, I recall an article by Patrick Buchanan. This was right after Obama's 2008 speech on race. And Patrick Buchanan said, you know, I'm so sick of hearing all of this stuff. You know, you want white guilt. Well, let me tell you, nobody has done more for black people than white people. We brought you here from Africa, and we gave you Christianity. We gave you affirmative action. We gave you welfare. We gave you student loans. This "we gave you" seems to make it exclusive and says we've done all that we can do, when in fact it is that very sense of mishistory that has helped create these dual narratives, these narratives that pass each other. And so we have got to take responsibility. When we begin to take responsibility fully, then we can begin to have a real dialogue.
Carol Anderson is Associate Professor of African American Studies and History at Emory University and the author of Bourgeois Radicals, the NAACP and the Struggle for Colonial Liberation, 1941 to 1960. Professor, thank you so much.
Thank you.
His genius won the war by breaking the Nazi military enigma codes, but his eccentricities exiled him from the world he helped save. Alan Turing's peek into the nature of consciousness and intelligence delivered insights we still use today in designing and evaluating computers, but his mathematical revelations also seemed to reveal an inner contradiction within his soul, the power and tragedy of which is worthy of Shakespeare. The story is all told in the film The Imitation Game, out this week, starring Benedict Cumberbatch.
You need me a lot more than I need you. I like solving problems, Commander. And Enigma is the most difficult problem in the world.
No, Enigma isn't difficult, it's impossible. The Americans, the Russians, the French, the Germans, everyone thinks Enigma is unbreakable.
Good. Let me try, and we'll know for sure, won't we?
The Imitation Game was inspired by the much more real historical biography, Alan Turing, The Enigma, by historian Andrew Hodges, who's also a mathematician and gay rights activist. He joins us from London. Andrew, welcome.
Hi, John. Thank you.
So Turing is such a fascinating character. So much of what we think of as an intelligent computer and the nature of machine consciousness comes from his original ideas. How do those ideas grow out of his work during the war effort?
Well, even before the war, you see, he had this fundamental theory of what computing was all about. And in the course of that, he discovered this idea that was just his idea of the universal Turing machine, which now people would see as the basic idea of the digital computer. But what the war did, if you're asking about that, was to turn that theory into something much more like practice. Now, you couldn't build anything like a universal machine, a computer, during the war. That wasn't done. The various machines they had for code-breaking were special machines. But it did bring Turing into direct contact, hands-on contact, with the technology, the cutting-edge technology of the period. And he saw in 1944-45 that that could be used to implement the computer. He also, through the war, had a very good knowledge of the scale of problems like guessing and judging, which people might have thought of as being human things to do, he saw as things which you could mechanize. But behind that is always, in Turing's thought, the basic interest in what the mind does. That's what had started him going on the problem of logic in the 30s, and that's what he described his computer plan as in 1945. He called it, quite cheekily, really, building a brain.
Now, were these original theories that predate the war, were they what got him onto the... And he was at Bletchley Park, right? He was part of that team, right? The Enigma
right.
team?
Right, it was a very interesting connection between the pre-war work and how he got into the code-breaking work. He took the initiative, but he saw the coming of Nazi Germany very early, and he built a machine out of binary multipliers in the physics workshop at Princeton with a physicist friend of his. And he brought that back to England in the summer of 1938. And it's clear that he had formed the opinion that war was coming and that he would like to be in on the crypto level, which in those days there was no textbook of or anything like that. He just sensed that this was the important thing for him to do. And so it was a seamless transition. Mm. He moved into that government department, which later became known as Bletchley Park when it moved there for the wartime period. And he was introduced to what they did in that summer of 1938. He then started full-time when the war between Britain and Germany began in September 1939.
Parallel to all this that was going on, did he have internally this sense of duality about hardware and software that we take for granted today in the way that we look at computers? Do you understand that there was a software dimension of his personality and a hardware dimension of his biological brain?
Absolutely. That goes right to the heart of what he was like. Very unusual for someone who would have been called a pure mathematician in the 1930s. That completely overlooks that he had this real yearning for doing things in a practical way, something which really would embody an abstract idea, which is exactly what the computer does. So as I've explained, he built this actual machine, and that was a very unusual sort of thing to do. That's not what mathematicians do, really. I mean, that's a weird thing. He did some other practical things like that as well. And that was what set him up exactly to be the kind of person who could take the logic of the Enigma and see a way through it by this following this idea of the consistencies and contradictions between the letters in the plain text and ciphertext, and turn that into design for a working machine. And those things just came together extremely quickly.
In his sexual identity and conflicts within himself that were so much a feature of his later life and tragic end, did he view his sexual orientation as a software problem, as a hardware problem, as a hardware problem he wanted to solve, as just something he had to live with? What did he psychologically? How did he deal with that?
There's a whole developing story. It's not a single story there. I mean, it's a developing life and developing society in which he lived. And so before the war, I think he was in a protected environment, being in the King's College, Cambridge environment. It's the environment of the John Maynard Keynes, Bloomsbury Group, literary people, that very tolerant area. And then after the war, he moved out of that and actually became much more confident as a modern-minded gay man after the Second World War, much more exploratory and interested positively in it.
Why do you think he killed himself?
Well, I think there was more of an internal conflict before the war, and he certainly, like any young gay man of that period, be very worried about what to do in society. How could you live? I mean, it was a very, very difficult thing. And then after the war, especially towards the end of his life, he became much more conscious of the developing situation of gay men. In fact, he'd continued to do work for what had become GCHQ, the British code-breaking establishment, after 1948, but that was stopped in 1952, and indeed in political military practice, gay men have been excluded from such work. So he was not welcome anymore, and of course he was a person with enormous secrets in his head. He held all the Second World War material from top to bottom, really, and extra things as well. That he was in a very, very isolated position, of which his friends really knew very little.
Well, a story shrouded in the 20th century, but yet filled with the seeds of all of the technological revolution that we're living in this century. Andrew Hodges, mathematician, gay rights activist, historian, author of Alan Turing, The Enigma, the biography that inspired the major motion picture, The Imitation Game. Andrew, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And now Thanksgiving. President Abraham Lincoln made Thanksgiving a national holiday, sustained like so much else in American politics by that river of money, that gravy of dollars that greases the tender lawmakers who can vote to subsidize this can of yams and give farmers a rebate on this bag of cranberries. Is there an app that you can hold over your Thanksgiving plate to see just what political contributions are behind your feast? Nope. Which is why we download Todd Zwillick each year on this day to give us the lowdown on the politics of what's on your plate.
Food prices are dropping. That's good. Take a look around the Thanksgiving table this year. Turkey, potatoes, vegetables, even frozen pies. Cheaper. Everything except butter, which is up like 15% over a year ago for some reason. Well, food is getting cheaper. Politics isn't. This is becoming kind of a tradition here on The Takeaway. I'm not sure how I feel about it. Here goes, because even the corporations that bring you Thanksgiving dinner are going nuts with the political action committees again this year. So let's start where it counts, the National Turkey Federation. They're the guys that bring the two turkeys for the president to pardon.
I need you to pardon another one. Aren't I going to get a reputation for being soft on turkeys?
When they're not posing for photo ops in the Rose Garden, they're spending $250,000 through their PAC in the last election. They gave $8,000 to Kay Hagan in North Carolina.
Wrong!
Oops, bad bet. She lost. Well, that's okay. Butterball PAC gave her $2,500. In fact, the Turkey Federation's PAC gave to 92 candidates for the midterm cycle. Tyson Foods produces a lot of turkey and chicken. Their PAC spent $224,000. Hedging their bets in Georgia, too, Tyson's PAC gave money to both GOP Senator-elect David Perdue and his primary challenger, Jack Kingston. But this is the best part. They wrote a $3,500 check to Senator Saxby Chambliss, who's retiring.
See ya!
Know who else likes to hedge? Pretty much everybody. But especially the National Beer Wholesalers Association, $4 million spent this cycle. You heard right, to wait for it, 450 congressional candidates. And they gave to three different candidates in the Georgia Senate race. The beer wholesalers played to both sides in Colorado, in Arkansas. Louisiana's not decided till next week. Republican Senate candidate Bill Cassidy got $5,000 from the beer wholesalers. Mary Landrieu only got $4,000. Could be decisive. Ocean Spray Cranberry PAC bet on Scott Brown, but got nothing for their $10,000 contribution in New Hampshire. Hey, are you getting on the road to grandma's this year? Gas is cheap, but a good chunk of your fill-up dollar is going to political agendas. BP set a PAC record in 2014. Between them, ExxonMobil, and ConocoPhillips, over $3 million on candidates. Happy trails.
Hot!
There are three NFL games on tomorrow. NFL's Gridiron PAC had a pretty slow year, actually. Only $550,000 slipped into the campaign coffers of congressional candidates. Well, there's a lot more in the Thanksgiving cash extravaganza we could talk about. Dairy producers, potato growers, Black Friday retailers, online retailers. I leave it to you, dear listener. It's all available from the Center for Responsive Politics and their fantastic website, opensecrets.org. But before you do, just remember, in all, PAC spent $440 million on the 2014 midterms, but they raised $1.5 billion. And that means they have lots of room left for 2016.
Thanks, Todd. Guests have arrived now. There's no super PAC that can bribe your five-year-old to try the Brussels sprouts, but there is an art to loading up your plate. Architecture and engineering. We call him the Frank Lloyd Wright of food, the Elon Musk of the modern meal. Tesla Dan Pashman, host of the Sporkful podcast, explains the perfect way to savor that high-performance moment of truth.
The foods you want to focus on at Thanksgiving are the ones that you can't get other times of the year, okay? The special items. What's your favorite bite at Thanksgiving, John? Like, describe to me, it's on the fork, it's going to go into your mouth, the bite that you're most excited to have at Thanksgiving.
That's interesting. It's you know, it's a bite of stuffing, roasted Brussels sprout, and a little bit of turkey breast with gravy.
In that order?
However it appears. I mean, just sort of all on the same fork.
That does sound like a good bite, so I commend you on that. But I would suggest that you might want to even give thought to the order in which those things appear on your fork. Because I've identified a concept that I call the proximity effect, which is that when you take any bite of food, whatever is in closest proximity to your tongue will be accentuated. All right, so whichever of those flavors you want the most of should end up on the tip of the fork. Now, you also have structural constraints to worry about. Stuffing is a tough thing to keep on the tip of the fork if it's a full fork. So you probably can't end with stuffing, but either those Brussels sprouts or the turkey will provide a nice cap for you.
I'm surprised how ideological some people are about particularly this snack issue. I mean, some people describe like the whole idea of eating anything before a Thanksgiving meal as an insult, as like you come to somebody's house and you're like pouring ink on the carpet.
Well, I agree. I think it is insulting when someone's been working all day and possibly for days to prepare this huge meal for you. But I will say that there's also some onus on the host don't you think? Because, like, the host needs to show respect for the eaters in the context of giving a good invitation that provides details, like, here's when we're going to eat. Like, when you invite people for Thanksgiving, you shouldn't just tell them when to arrive. You should also let them know when you're expecting to sit down to eat. Because
mm-hmm.
we eaters need to plan ahead for that kind of thing.
So cocktails at 5, dinner at 6.
Right, whatever it is. People want to know that, and I want to know that before the day of Thanksgiving, because my whole day is being planned. It's all a buildup to the crescendo of mealtime, and I want to be ready for that crescendo.
Here's Jeff. 1 year, my wife's aunt, who had volunteered to bring the turkey, called 30 minutes after dinner was supposed to start to say she was just leaving and would be at our house in about an hour. She said she would finish cooking the turkey when she got to our house. Should we have eaten without her and the turkey?
I mean,
that's...
There are so many things wrong.
I'm thinking death penalty.
Yeah,
I mean, I'm thinking...
First of
class
all...
Class A felony. I mean, really, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, if you're going to entrust the turkey to someone who's not at your house on the morning of Thanksgiving...
Right.
Like, they're not waking up at your house, you better make sure that's a person you can count on. Now, I'm sure that Jeff's aunt has many fine qualities, but it seems like reliability may not be one of them. In Jeff's particular case, I would say you got to wait for the turkey. I mean, it's Thanksgiving. You got to wait.
You
got to wait.
You don't have a choice.
And also the question is, like, how far along was the turkey cooked? The aunt is going to – she's now traveling in the car with partially cooked turkey, which in itself is a food safety hazard because now it's dropping in temperature. When bacteria see a partially cooked turkey driving down the street, they're like, it's their lucky day.
Yeah. So she's trying to kill them.
Now you got
to
overcook
she's
the turkey.
She's trying to annoy them.
I mean, really, this is – I hope you had some good pie, Jeff.
All right. So for the meal itself, the sitting down, the camaraderie, the I'm not too full, the leave room for dessert thing. What's the rule that you would say is the most useful for people celebrating Thanksgiving in this year of 2014?
Well, from the eating perspective, it's understand that a bite is a precious resource.
Right.
There's only so much stomach space. Use it well. Focus on the highlights. And take a break between dinner and dessert.
Ah.
And go for a walk. The constitutional, the post-dinner constitutional, crucial, okay? Get a little bit of your appetite back, then go for dessert.
I'd be happy to have you around my table, Dan.
Oh, thank you. Is that an invitation?
Yeah, it's an invitation. Can I come over to your house one of these days, too? Yeah?
You're more than welcome. You got it.
Dan Pashman, the friendly host of WNYC's Sporkful podcast and author of the new book, Eat More Better, How to Make Every Bite More Delicious. And as we've learned, a bite is a...
precious resource.
Thanks, Dan.
Thanks, John.
Go to thetakeaway.org. Dan has invited everyone in America to his house on Thanksgiving. His address is at thetakeaway.org. I'm kidding. Sorry, Dan. Thanks for listening. Have a great Thanksgiving. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
PRI, Public Radio International.